Were there scientific demands or requests that you couldn't accommodate, that
There will have
seamanship
been.
had to come first?
I think the problem was that most of what a lot of what was, I mean, there just was not room to fit a lot of the scientific requirements. But of course, any decision to whether a particular the weight that should be given to a request for particular fitment for a particular scientist would, was handled by other people rather than me. So that those decisions were taken elsewhere. I was able to say though whether it would fit and whether we could whether we, I mean, if it was a question of whether there was manpower on board and the technical ability on board to be able to operate and maintain the equipment, then my opinion would come into that.
So as a sea captain at that table, your prime concern was the quality of the ship from the seaman's point of view.
Yes, and to be able to work it so that we could. We didn't have dynamic positioning, but we needed to be able to maintain the vessel in a stationary position. So we had to have the navigational instrumentation that would tell us as accurately as possible what the position was, and so that we could maintain it just on the basis of the positioning equipment. But we had to have good visibility from the bridge over all the working areas. We had to have really good communications between the bridge and any winch position down aft. We had to have the maneuverability of the vessel to be able to maintain position even in the worst possible weather conditions, so that those aspects of design were key really to whether the ship was going to operate successfully in the Southern Ocean. If we hadn't have had perhaps the power that we did, or the maneuverability that we did, the good sea keeping that the ship had, then our weather window for doing most of the scientific operations would have been lower, and it just would not have been as efficient. So all those things were vital, really, for a ship to work in that environment.
The construction process fell behind schedule, and I wonder if that led to any compromises.
It didn't, but not without a fight. I mean, it wasn't really the falling behind schedule so much, although the fact that it was being launched by the Queen had a role to play in that, because they had to get, having this being agreed months and months beforehand, they had a deadline that they could not miss, so that there were sort of shortcuts being attempted towards that when the date was getting close to the launch date. But after that, it was more on the financial side rather than the time side. Although there were financial penalties to Swan Hunters if they were late. It was more that the cost of the vessel had, the actual build cost had far exceeded their expectations, and they were losing money on it, so that they were forced to try and cut corners, and then it was the vigilance of my team that were able to try and spot where shortcuts were being taken and stop it. So it all became very tense at that.
Cat and mouse.
Yes, it was a bit, but Swan, I give Swan Hunters their due. They were really very honest about it. There was nothing. They were in a caught between a rock and a hard place, really. They wanted to produce the best possible ship. There's no doubt about it, and I think to some extent they were a victim of their own that policy, really, because they did build a good ship, but and they didn't effectively didn't charge enough money for it in the first place.
Do you feel like that contributed towards their
I'm sure it did. I'm sure it did, and it was followed by a Royal Fleet auxiliary ship called the Fort George, which was also similarly over budget, I think.
Were you having to agree compromises which you went against your better judgment?
No.
So you were never going.
No, we had fights. We had discussions, but no, we didn't compromise. In fact, I can't remember it. As far as I remember, everything was built to specification. It was just that the care that had been shown to begin with wasn't shown in those last few months, because they were desperate to get the ship out, not to incur any costs through being any more costs than necessary through being late. So they were desperate to get it out of the yard. And it was with fantastic relief that we've eventually sort of sailed it down the Tyne and out to sea.
So when he got it to sea, how did he feel about it?
It was a fantastic feeling. It's slightly marred by the fact that we'd been out on sea trials. Presumably it must have been a month or two beforehand, which was the first time that the ship had actually put to sea. Because of the legal ownership situation, the captain at that time was one of the Tyne pilots, and I was just observing, because the ship was still owned by the shipyard at that stage contractually, and so it had been to sea, and I'd experienced it, but not in slightly odd circumstances, and. So slightly detracted from the fact that when we put it out to sea, that time when we finally left the yard, that it wasn't the first time that it had been to sea, but nevertheless it was terrific, and the weather was really good, and to have it out at sea and just with our own crew on board was a fantastic feeling, and it seemed to just work very well indeed. we went trying the first voyage was just down to Portsmouth to start to get some aircraft fuel on board to deliver in the Antarctic. So it was a straightforward passage down the east coast of England.
As the ship came into more testing waters, how did it cope?
It's always proved its value, really. It's met its specification. It hasn't gone beyond the specification, but it's certainly met it, I think, in every respect. We had teething problems in the first year for several years actually, with the winches on board, but that was nothing to do with the shipbuilders. That was more because it was a very innovative design that hadn't really been worked through properly. So we had problems with winches, which took up an inordinate amount of time of the technical team on board. And we also had, more worryingly, we had trouble with pipework on board, yeah, which went on for a couple of years. But the worst time was in the first season, where we had some very worrying leaks in the engine room. With these are big pipes, 2 foot in diameter, that were leaking.
That was corrosion, was it?
Yes, it was never really. I think it's more erosion than corrosion, but they were really high tech pipes, some sort of bronze alloy. I can't remember the alloy now, but. They were high tech, very thin walled pipes, and the solution eventually was to put a sort of glass layer inside all the pipes, which we did a couple of years later. 2 years later, then we had a refit down in Plymouth, and all the engine room pipes went off and were coated with this sort of glass, a glass layer inside the, inside each pipe, and that that's cured the problem as far as I understand.
And again, just for so I get this right, these were pipes that carry seawater for cooling the engine.
Yes, yeah. Massive, you know, 2 foot in diameter, yeah, pipes, some of them, and they're carrying huge volumes of seawater. And the some of the problems were before the valve, the sea valves, so that potential disaster, as in fact the similar problem to the HMS Endurance has suffered this year in the Antarctic. They've had a flooded engine room because of a failure in that system.
Were you nervous?
I have to confess to being nervous at one stage.
Can you tell me about that?
The Bransfield had trouble. It was the Bransfield and the James Clark Ross were working in the Antarctic that year, and I think it must have been the second voyage of the James Clark Ross, because I think that's when the pipework problems really manifested themselves. But we'd been asked to go to the rescue of the Bransfield, because the Bransfield had its propulsion motor burnt out. And we charged down. It was a good excuse to use the full power of the James Clark Ross. There were a few occasions in the first 2 or 3 years, either for medical emergencies or because of this rescuing the Bransfield, that we were able to actually put the engines at full speed, because there must have been a very high fuel prices, I think, because there were economies, and we were under strict instructions not to use full power. Anyway, we went to the rescue of the Bransfield in the Weddell Sea, arrived at the Bransfield position, and we were just about to prepare to tow her. Which had never been done before. We'd spent best part of a day on the communicating with the between the ships, trying to dream up a way that we could actually achieve this successfully and tow the Bransfield out of the ice, the pack ice that she was in, and up to Stanley and beyond. And we chased down there, probably. I can't remember exactly, but it's probably we were in off South Georgia. We had to break off a scientific program, I think, and it would have been 3 or 4 days steaming. We got to the position of the Bransfield, and we're just manoeuvring to go alongside when we heard that they'd fixed their propulsion motor. So we then escorted the Bransfield up to the Falkland Islands. But it was during that voyage, escorting the Bransfield, that we had a particularly bad leak that we were unable to do anything about. And really, whereas we were there to escort the Bransfield up to the Falkland Islands, I think I was really pleased to get in the Falkland Islands and be able to get some our own repairs done on it.
Because so the Bransfield was almost escorting you, was it?
Well, I don't think they knew about it. They would have done. We'd have told them. But we still had power, low power, if I remember rightly. But I remember being particularly worried, because there was nothing. There was very very little we could do about it at that stage, and we'd stemmed the inflow of water as much as possible, but it was the worry that if it just got a little bit worse, or if another pipe went, then we would be in serious trouble.
Your plan B was already in use, was it?
Yes, it was, yeah.
You seem to have a lot of teething troubles with silly things like the anemometer and the spare part arriving, which is the wrong part, and searchlights failing and winches failing and the decking lifting. And but that must be very frustrating for you.
No, well, I don't think so. I think any new ship, I mean, it's a tremendously complex bit of kit. So you're bound to get a certain amount of problems. I think it. I found the decking was very disappointing, because a lot of effort had gone in to get that right. But things like, I mean, that's typical of my 20 years experience in the Antarctic. There's always things going wrong, and you always have to sort of make do. And generally, you can make do without a problem. I think that, looking back on it, I think the worst thing about the James Clark Ross is actually the windows. We had specified that, and that was taking the experience from the Bransfield, that all the windows in the ship should be brass windows bolted onto the steel superstructure. And that's because of that's the way that Bransfield was built. And those windows had lasted, at that time, 20 years. And 20 years? No, 10 years. No, 20 years, sorry. And they had really, really, really worked well. The Swan Hunters were very reluctant to put brass windows in. I thought that it was because they were trying to save money. And because it was much more labour intensive to put in brass windows. And so we insisted on brass windows, and they went ahead and did them. But they've been a real problem ever since. And I think it's because the superstructure was not of the same scantling, same thickness as the steel superstructure. Not as the same thickness as Bransfield's, same strength. And because of that, the superstructure moves, and you get rust appearing between the steel and the edges of the steel, and they're just constantly running with rust, so they're a real maintenance problem. So that was a mistake. Probably we should have gone for the steel frame windows that Swan Hunters suggested.
I read somewhere that when the seas were rough, she had a habit of slipping back down the wave, off the back of the wave. I think that was, I'm paraphrasing what you wrote, but.
Mm.
That she would shudder because as she went over the wave, the stern would dip down a bit into the back of the wave.
I don't remember that, but I mean I'm sure that's true. It's not that unusual for ships like that, but it sounds as though we must have been taking water over the stern.
You mentioned that 2-3 times.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that may be the case. Of course, she had quite a low exposed stern deck for the scientific. For deploying scientific equipment, and that may very well have been the case that we occasionally sort of slipped back and dug the stern in. But I was never really very nervous about the stability, the seaworthiness of James Clark Ross. I suppose because I'd seen pretty well every plate being welded together, and I'd seen the care that had gone into the design that. I was confident that she could withstand anything that could be thrown at her down there. That wasn't necessarily true of so much of the Bransfield. Bransfield gave me cause for concern on many occasions because she rolled really badly, very violently, and it was very uncomfortable on board the Bransfield frequently in bad weather through really excessive rolling. And at those times, you do wonder when the seas are just absolutely enormous, much higher than the bridge, especially at night, I think, when you can't really see them properly. You can just sense these huge seas, and the ship is rolling badly, and things are crashing around in all over the place, inevitably. You do wonder whether the naval architects have got have done their sums correctly and that it will stay afloat. Although you can't communicate that fear, that worry to others on board. You just try and pretend that that you're as confident as can be.
There's a word you use quite a lot in those masters report, the annual reports, which is the word is unfortunately.
All right.
And did you feel as though you had misfortune?
No, I mean we obviously the winches were a constant problem. No, the winches were a constant problem. I think the when the pipework problems started to materialise, then that was a a worry. So, and I suppose you tend to think, well, that you feel responsible to some extent that you know this is a ship that you've had more to do with the design than anybody else, and it's not, in a couple of respects at least, is not going according to plan. So maybe that's why the word unfortunately crept in.
It usually preceded a minor detail, such as the anchor being bent, or poor mooring lines, or the eye on the end of a mooring line being the wrong kind.
Yes.
But there was also one incident where you were dropping a hook over the side of the boat to pick up a tender, or a humber, was it?
A humber.
And it caught under the handle of the
humber
and turfed everything into the water.
That was a really quite worrying time.
Describe what happened.
We were at Cygni Island, and it was, as usual, wherever we were working, whether we were on Bransfield, Biscoe or James Clark Ross, you tended to be always seemingly working in marginal conditions, because you'd often get to a base and it would be unworkable, and so you'd wait until it was just workable, and then you would go. And I think that was the circumstances at Cygni, I believe, was that we'd had a successful couple of days of cargo work, and it was virtually the last boat, and it must have been the last boat of the last season, because we were taking out the Aquaria from the base, and we used to bring the Aquaria on board and put it in our own fridges, and to take live fish back to Cambridge. And this was one of the Aquaria, was in this inflatable boat with one of my officers and a crew member, and the conditions had blown up. We'd had decent weather, we'd got most of the job done, and you get to the last boat, do your decisions whether you're going to go with the last boat
one
more, because then you can get on the voyage and get off and do the next task. And it was the last boat, weather had got up, and the coxswain of the boat was not that experienced. I think that was his first voyage down there. Anyway, as you say, I think grab handles of the boat caught on a ladder that had over the side, the hook caught on. Yeah, caught on one of the handles, the grab handles on the side of the boat, tipped the Aquaria into the water, tipped the two guys into the water, turned the boat upside down, and the boat drifted away. Fortunately, there was a ladder over the side. It was the only boat in the water, because the other boat had just been recovered. So rather than have two boats in the water at a time, we had that. But there's always that, you're always vulnerable when you've got the second one home and there's still one in the water. And that was the case this time. So we didn't have a boat in the water. The boat drifted away. The aquarium had gone to the seabed, but the two guys were able to climb up the ladder, fortunately.
How do the scientists feel about losing their specimens?
They're always very pragmatic. I mean, of course, it's upsetting. It would have been upsetting for somebody, because somebody's research would be important to somebody's research. But it was only one of about four or five, so it wasn't a total loss. And we were able to, if my memory serves me correctly, we were able to get more samples out from ashore, and so supplement the stock that we already had on board. So I don't think it was. I never heard that it was a sort of disaster for anybody. And I'm afraid these things happen in the Antarctic to some extent. And at least it was a. It was an accident. I don't know whether you know, but one of the first voyages on the... Well, it would have been my first voyage on the Bransfield. There was a lot of samples thrown over the side. It happened just as the ship was closing the UK coast after an 8-month voyage in the Antarctic, and some crew members. There was an. It must have been actually. It would have been in the tropics or on the way north. There was some crew members became upset that they weren't allowed to store some beer, I think, in a freezer or a fridge that they had been able to do previously. The scientists had stopped them doing it, and one night some samples were thrown over the side, and that was. That was the basis for two people's PhDs. That they'd been 2 years in the Antarctic collecting these samples, and it was an absolute disgrace and a disaster for those guys. Was a really black point in the my experience in Bass.
In your final, I think it's your final report, you make a few recommendations, bits that are underlined in your reports, particularly about loading and unloading at Bird Island, I seem to recall. And a couple of times you say, I have mentioned this in previous reports.
Yes.
And nothing's happening.
Yes.
And I just wonder whether there was any sense that deaf ears were being turned, or whether that was a frustration for you. Were your underlinings always acted upon, or
no, they weren't.
Happening several thousand miles away, and therefore
they weren't. But there's always an unrealistic expectation that anything that we might want as the masters of the Bass ships. That we should get, and that is unrealistic because there are other factors that have to be borne in mind. But that doesn't stop you trying to fight your corner and emphasise the need in any way you can. I mean, that's perhaps why the underlining was there rather than frustration. I've always got on well with the people in the office. I think mutually. Understanding they understand that we have problems on the ships, but I also understand that there isn't unlimited resources to provide all the solutions that we want. Nevertheless, Bird Island it's a fantastic, from a scientific point of view, it's absolutely essential to have a base there, but from a logistics supply point of view, it's at the worst place you could pick to put a base, and that isn't just somebody sort of thinking that this is hard work. It is actually dangerous. You're working in these marginal conditions all the time, and marginal conditions off Bird Island have to be pretty risky. I mean, you're stretching the point really to sometimes working there. Dangerous for many respects, but it's usually the swell alongside the ship, from loading the cargo into the barges alongside, where the cargo, big heavy loads are swinging around. Inevitably, people are in the barge. It used to be a wooden scow in the old days, but now we have these sort of landing craft. But the people can't, the people that have to unhook the loads can't move out of the way. They can. There's nowhere to go. They'd have to jump over the side to get away from a load that was swinging out of control. So we had to develop all sorts of techniques which were peculiar to Bass, really, and to working at Bird Island to maintain stability of loads. And then you had the danger of people climbing, getting out of boats onto ladders and climbing ladders on the side of the ship. And then finally the danger of actually lifting up boats with people in it at the end of the day. And so many times that happens in poor weather conditions that it's a real worry. It's probably, you know, it's probably the one of the most worrying times for the master, because you know that you're pushing the limit really in order to get it done.
Did you have any second line of recourse to HQ? You could write it in your report. If it didn't happen, could you go into somebody's office and bang on the desk?
Yeah, you could. I didn't actually ever need to do that. I don't think, but yes, if the request of the immediate people that we communicate in the office didn't meet with success, if we felt it. Felt strongly enough, we'd go directly to the director and put the put our views to him.
But you never did that.
Never had to do that. No. Yeah. No, I never felt so strongly about it that would be necessary.
Compared to your day trips around the Queensland Barrier Reef.
Yes.
You were constantly dealing with new problems all the time, weren't you?
Yes.
Not only because it was a new ship. And therefore there were teething troubles, but it also, because it was the Antarctic and the weather was so variable, the environment in which you were working was constantly changing.
Yes.
What kind of long-term effects did that have upon your stamina, your confidence?
I don't think it had any. I mean, I enjoyed that. I mean, that's what I imagine that all my colleagues would say. That's why they do the job, because of that variety that you get each day and the challenges that each day throws up that you have to meet in different ways, in innovative ways, in many cases. I felt that, for me, as being a Worcester cadet, I had been. Trained in seamanship and boat handling, I think the boating skills that I learnt at Worcester were really useful to me in Bass. But I felt that I was using everything that I'd learnt from a navigational point of view as well. You really have to use basic. You have to go back to basic. Basic methods of navigation on occasions. You have to use even innovative ways to actually get positions, to know where you are, to be able to manoeuvre into tight places. So you were being stretched all the time, and that wasn't a problem. That was the enjoyment of it, really.
Didn't shorten your shelf life?
I don't think so. No, I mean, I would have, personally. I would have. I mean, that's why masters. I think I'm the only master that has ever. Tom Woodfield actually left Bass in 1973 to come ashore to be full time elder brother of Trinity House, and after 73, I think since 73, I think I'm the only master that's ever left. But I didn't leave because I didn't like the job. I left because I got three young children and a family, and I'd been supervising the James Clark Ross throughout its build. I'd taken it to sea for three years. It was working, and it was working well. I didn't know what else I could do to actually meet. To match that, the enjoyment that I'd got out of all that, but also the pressure on the family, wife and three children. We were living up in the wilds of Northumberland. Didn't have any other close family there, so it was pretty tough on occasions. Even if you're only away for 4 months at a time, as we were, so that was all part of the equation. For the decision to come ashore.
Difficult one?
Oh, very difficult.
Where was your heart?
My heart was, and always has been, with Bass, really. But I was doing a job. I came ashore to be to work for the Marine Accident Investigation Branch, which is in itself a very, very interesting job, very privileged job, because you get to you speak to people perhaps that have had the the most traumatic event, just had the most traumatic event of their life, and the, you know, you have every weapon to try and encourage them to be as open with you as possible. So, and it's all about seamanship and navigation and rapport with other mariners and things. So that's close to my, very close to my heart as well. So it was a really good job, but my heart actually remained with Bass, so much so that I'd been ashore about a year or two, and I was in serious discussions with Bass whether to come back, not as a master, but as sort of superintendent ashore, to look at the instigation of a safety management system.
Did you feel that the diplomacy you may have learnt on board those Antarctic going vessels,
yes,
was useful when you were dealing with people who had crises in,
yes,
in your...
I'm sure it is. Whether it, and it must be. That is a skill that I that is useful at MAIB, and it's a skill that I do have, and I presume that it must be a skill that I developed at Bass, because you certainly need it there in dealing with scientists and visitors and Argentinians and all sorts of people.
This is the one question that most people struggle to answer. Why was your heart with Bass? Why? What is it about the Antarctic, or working with the Antarctic as your backdrop, that is so engaging?
I think it's the environment is part of it without a doubt. My attraction to the scenery, the sheer grandeur and beauty of the Antarctic, with the wildlife as well. I mean, I could and did spend hours just standing on the wing of the bridge, or looking out from the ship, landing on beaches, and just enjoying the solitude and the fantastic scenery and the so it's a really special place. But I also think it's the camaraderie of working with people, the sort of people that also like that environment and like to go down there. I was really interested in the scientific work that the ship was doing as well. Not that I'm a scientist or could even pretend to have any to be able to offer anything anything to their programs, but it was nevertheless, it was very rewarding to know more about what was going on board the ship in order to be able to understand what the ultimate goal was, and how you as the ship's master or ship's crew member were contributing to that. So it was the fact that you were part of this big family, really. And in the early days, and a lot of the excitement and the enthusiasm for the Antarctic came from the days, I would say, in the 1970s, when each voyage was an expedition, and particularly on the Bransfield, which was mainly a logistics support ship. It did very little scientific work from it. In fact, no scientific work in the early days. It was purely a logistics support vessel, and you took 60 odd recent graduates, most of them from university, and some diesel mechanics and cooks and others, but all of that sort of age group, early 20s. And you took them out on their big adventure, and you left, when the ship left from Southampton, as it was in those days, there'd be all the families would be there, it'd be a dramatic goodbye. These youngsters would be going off for the 2 years into the Antarctic, into the unknown. And you, as the ship's crew, you saw these young lads, and they were all lads then, at that stage in their lives. You took them down. You saw them in the intervening year when they were on the base, and you were delivering their mail and supplies, and then eventually you brought them out, and you could see the change that had occurred to them, and you shared their excitement, really, and I think some responsibility for them. I mean, in those days, the ship's masters were, in particular, the ship's masters were the senior management representative. So their responsibilities weren't confined to the ship. They used to do inspections of the bases, and they were, if there were problems that needed BAS management to intervene, then the masters had to perform that role as well. So you were very, very much part of the whole exciting Antarctic scientific project, and that was terrific for somebody that otherwise would be just driving cargo from one place to another.
It was emotion.
Yes, I think so. I would say it probably was. And as you described it as the backdrop of the Antarctic as well, and that was a really exciting place, exciting from a professional point of view, but also exciting from the fact that so many other people were excited by it, and you were there sharing it with them as well. So I mean, it was a really good place to work and to grow up in, really. I mean, I was only 23 myself, I suppose, when I joined there. So similar age to most of the scientists going down.